Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by Gary O'Reilly, a fascinating former pro in England who now is a host of the podcast Playing with Science. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Just a quick disclaimer, the first few minutes of audio have some occasional issues, but stick with us. They go away very quickly. Onward. Joining me now is Gary O'Reilly. He played for 14 seasons as a pro in England with four clubs, including Tottenham, Brighton, and Crystal Palace. And he scored a goal in the 1990 FA Cup final for Palace. He is the only defender ever to score in the semifinal and final of the same year's FA Cup. These days, he's a host of the terrific podcast Playing with Science, which you should definitely check out. And he's also in New York City a lot these days. You can find him on Twitter at My3LeftFeet, spelled out. Gary, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Great to have you in studio here. And first off, I really like your podcast. And
thank you.
It's called Playing with Science. Yeah. It goes pretty far afield. Mm-hmm. Could you explain to listeners what it's about?
You give me sport, and I will give you the science. It's as simple as that. I don't bring the science. I have some really smart people, and I do not include myself in that sentence, that have the knowledge to extricate the science, be it the physics, the biology, the chemistry, the neurology, even to the point where I will drill down into data analytics. I will find an astrophysicist, and this show hasn't broken yet, so you're going to love this one. Dr. Meredith Wills is an astrophysicist. She's also a super sleuth and found the reason why there were more home runs hit during 2015 and 2017 is because the laces that were used to stitch the balls together are 9% thicker. There's a whole load of physics in there, which I'm not going to spoil, but when someone is that smart and dissects the science and does the investigation, I'm in. I sit there every show, basically, and every show's a school day. I get taught stuff I didn't even know. And as you said in your introduction, 14 years as a professional player, I have seen a thing or two, but they take me to school and sit me down and they teach me things. It's incredible.
I love how much variety there is in what you do on this podcast. And certainly it's not all soccer. It's not all sports. How did this happen? I don't run into too
how
many.
How far back do you want to go?
I don't run into too many players or ex-players who do what you're doing.
I've always sort of been accused of marching to a different beat. And this just interests me. I'd always be looking at what next for football. Mm-hmm. Where does it go next? How do we assess talent? How do we see the game evolving in leagues? How do we see the game evolving as the game? Is it still going to be as beautiful as it once was? Is it going to be a difference? Is it going to be a Picasso? Is it going to be a Renoir? How do we look at this? I was working for the BBC. Yes. And I was up in the Northeast, Premier League game, Sunderland versus Crystal Palace. It just happened to be Crystal Palace. And I have to take a train from the very south coast of England to the very northeast of England. Mm-hmm. It's about 5.5 hours or so of me sitting down looking out of a window. Mm-hmm. I get on the train, come back. There is someone sat opposite me. They work for NASA. And the conversation starts to go between us. that person ends up being the executive producer, the creator and originator of the multiple Emmy-nominated Star Talk on National Geographic. This show hasn't been birthed yet, so there is someone there who's obviously thinking about radio and broadcasting and is taking this forward, becomes a radio show, becomes an outstanding podcast, and then is taken on to television. They then wanted to expand the Star Talk brand and into areas where they felt there was a definite room to grow, and sport was an obvious. Mm-hmm. There are other things waiting to be explored, but sport was something that they thought front and center. So I'd always sort of kept the contact with the producer, and they came to me and said, would you be interested in developing this with us? And I said, okay. And we went from there. So I think we hit some low-hanging fruit. We started off with a Super Bowl show. Mm-hmm. It was early January, made sense. We did Odell Beckham Jr.'s Catch. Mm-hmm. But rather than just go, well, Gary, you're not alone. Everybody's done that. Not everybody got the guy who helped develop the glove that he wears to catch and the science therein and the science that they ignored. Mm-hmm. Like a gecko's foot has hundreds and millions of microscopic hairs on it that create a suction. That's why it can climb up walls and on ceilings. Mm-hmm. They thought about that as technology, but it came in at too expensive. So they kind of just moved that to one side and went with something else. And so we get into those sort of areas. Then we'll go and explore curling. Mm-hmm. Because why not? Why not explore curling? Then go to, where do you get next-gen stats in NFL? Well, there's two microchips, one in each shoulder pad, and it's telemetrics. Mm-hmm. And it's not just telemetrics. They run X amount of yards at X amount of speed. That means the acceleration was X plus whatever. They give you biodata feedback. Hmm. So we went into that area. Got the guys at Bauer Hockey Equipment. They developed a collar to help with head injuries. You get into the stick and the manufacturer of the stick and why and how. We have a physics professor in Canada who's actually a gold miner.
Nice.
So we find people. We have a fabulous guy, Professor Eric Goff, down in Lynchburg, Virginia. He is across all sorts of sport, from soccer to football to everything, and he's a black belt in karate and Krav Maga. So we did Fight Like a Physicist with him. And you're laughing because my co-host is a stand-up comedian, Chuck Nice. Yeah. So we have fun, because I think you must have fun. But in the same way, you bring that with you. You bring that science. You open it up. You don't make it exclusive. You make it as inclusive as possible. So idiots like me can actually understand what's going on. And sometimes I sit there and smile because I don't understand at all. It goes over my head. But I go away and think about it. And I think that's what people can find interesting and attractive about playing with science.
Were you this curious during your playing career and about the world, and how did your teammates respond to that if you were?
They just looked at me weird. And in the end, you stop involving them in your thought process because you know that there's a custard pie on the end of whatever sentence you're about to utter. So you don't utter it. You stay out of it. And then you go off and you think and you just look at... I looked at the world in a different way. And, it works sometimes. Being a team player, it's okay to be Maverick if you're Neymar Jr. If you're not, you better toe the party line. Because in the end, and I come to understand this at some point in my career, I won't put a mark on the timeline, that it's the team that wins, not the individual. And the sooner you get to that understanding, and hopefully you have that before you enter professional sport, this is how it works, to the betterment of the team and therefore the betterment of you. You keep doing what the coach says, the coach is more likely to play you. And the objective is to be played by the coach. So that's, you see things in a different way. Your mind gets opened up in respect of professional sport is this, and it has to be this. And there's no room for you bringing what you think, your different take on the world. So you compartmentalize that, you put it to one side, and you do what is necessary. So you kind of come in with some fresh ideas and thoughts, and they just go, what did we say? And okay, fine. And then you take it forwards, and then you can have some room when you get to a certain point to have self-expression.
Okay. Do you think football today, including in England, is a little more open to new ideas than maybe when you were playing?
100%.
It seems like it.
100%.
In what way?
Okay. Tactically, everything's been done before. You're going to revisit history. And because it's been so far back, it's going to seem new, shiny, and bright. Okay, fine. Inverting the Pyramid, Jonathan Wilson, any listener who is a soccer fan, please go and read that book if you want to understand what I've just said and have it explained to you in such wonderful detail. And you're nodding because you know the book. And it's
Sports Illustrated writer Jonathan Wilson.
That's the fella. Nothing like a bit of in-house plugging there. So I looked at that and I thought, then you find people like Cruyff come through. And that then brings, and then you have Guardiola takes Cruyff's thinking and opens that up. Then you find the people in the UK, this little tiny island of, you know, this very English thing of, no, we invented the game, therefore we can do it better than anybody else. No, we haven't won a World Cup forever, but that's not the point, right? So all of a sudden you find managers, that might be useful for us. Bring that in, let's talk about that. And you found that people were all of a sudden thinking about strength and conditioning in a different way. Rather than building the perfect beast with all of the muscles, it was more plyometrics, it was more Pilates yoga, it was more about flexibility, more about lithe athleticism with the addition of muscle, but not too much. And then you think about the data analytics, the use of technology, the use of video analysis, the phalanx of data analysts that the large Premier League clubs, Bundesliga, La Liga, Serie A clubs have, and why they have them, and the information that's brought to players, that is a giant step forward compared to the days that I had. We would get game tape. I would ask for game tape and sit down and look at things and watch things. If I could get game tape of someone I was playing against, which was a bit harder if we were playing in Europe and I was at Tottenham, but still I could go and ask and see if we could bring stuff back, or I'd get tape of other things. And it wasn't readily available. So all of that has come forward, and the coaches understand, the players understand. The management of the game, both from coaches and from the officials, is changing. And so, yeah, there is an openness to embracing new ideas. VAR, the video assistant referee, that has to come in. It has to be perfected. It's at 98.8% accuracy, which isn't that bad. But someone's always going to scream and kick because it's not 100% accurate. So as is, we just have to look at our own selves and say, do we find 98.8% acceptable or not?
And this is a question for me, and also too, about England, which I'm hoping you can explain to me a bit, is England to me seems to be maybe the most resistant country to VAR, because we don't currently see it in the Premier League. They decided not to use it this season. And there's a difference, obviously, between how VAR is designed to be used and how it's actually used in practice. And so I get that. But if it, like, the way I look at it was in the World Cup last year, for example, I think VAR was an upgrade over what was before. It wasn't 100% perfect. Is there something about England that a lot of people there think it needs to be 100% perfect?
Yes. We would all like 100% perfect.
Right.
And we must all attempt to achieve perfection, and knowing in whatever it is we do that we can't achieve it, but we must strive for it. I think you'll be surprised to hear where I go with this.
Okay.
Money.
Really?
Yeah. How much is it worth to a Premier League team before the season kicks off? It's, what is it, £90 million?
Something like that, yeah.
You know, over $100 million, US dollars. So there's an awful lot at stake. And then you add to that all of the other bonuses. This is important. Get that one critical decision wrong. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Where are you going to go with this? Does it end up in litigation? There's, you know, you've not just upset the boardroom of one club. You've got a whole army of fans. Everything can go. So I think what they've done is been, I say typically British, but well, let's see how this goes in the other leagues before we dive in and then find ourselves experiencing problems that the other leagues have experienced. Because there's been resistance in Bundesliga, not everybody's happy in Serie A. There is VAR in the FA Cup this season, but only if the games are played in a Premier League venue.
But it's crazy to me that it's not the same for every game.
That's bonkers. I agree with you. that again is quintessential British attitude. But I think, and I mean, a cynical view, it does look as if everybody's concerned about we need to get this as right as possible. Going back to the World Cup in Russia, if you left it to the referees themselves, I think it's 93% accuracy, which is excellent. But VAR's taking it that 5% further forward. Everybody wants more, as I said. So I think there will be VAR. I believe it's already been published that there will be VAR for the coming season. So that's 2020. Mm-hmm. So that will hopefully. My only concern is now when referees refereed the game, they managed the game. They owned the game. Mm-hmm. Their responsibility was to keep this 22 schoolboys running around being difficult and screaming and shouting and kicking each other and pulling the hair when no one was looking. All that stuff, right? Manage them. Think about, yes, they understood the professional side of it. They understood the responsibilities and they managed the individual. They managed the game. Now the potential, and I call it potential rather than say this is what will happen. The potential is there that the referees will kind of stand back and allow a decision to be made on their behalf in a remote location, which then kind of flies in the face of what FIFA said for many, many years. We will not introduce technology because we want the authority to be in the hands of the referee. Mm. Well, that doesn't seem to happen anymore, does it? So it's that situation. It's that point where, I want the referee to have responsibility. I want the referee to have authority and that authority be respected. Have I ever sworn at a referee before in a game? Yes. So I am not polishing my halo as we speak. No, I have been the sinner. That's why I think, and I think that maybe they have the right approach to think about it and be slightly cautious, see how it goes in the World Cup, do all the research, do all the work that's needed, correlate the data, and we're back to science again, and then take it forward and hopefully improve on 98.8% if they possibly can.
I do want to ask a question. In the introduction, I mentioned you are the only defender ever to score a goal in the FA Cup semifinal and final of the same year's tournament. You didn't score a lot of goals in your career.
No.
What were the circumstances of this?
Okay, so this was for Crystal Palace in 1990, and we were not pound for pound at that point going to compete with Manchester United, with Liverpool, with Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham, etc. However, we were very well organised. Not so much the Westminster dog show as a bunch of mongrels, right? Let loose. And we were tenacious, interpret that as you wish. We were determined. Some of us had points to prove, but we worked out that from set plays, we could be devastating. I used to be quite the person on the near post to flick on Ian Wright, Mark Bright. Ian Wright, I'm sure listeners will be more than familiar with, even if it's through Bradley and the
son
Sean.
Former podcast guest.
Yes.
Wonderful guy.
Yep, absolutely. So it came to me that we had one set play in the semi-final. ball drops in the 6-yard box, and on occasion I can be lethal from that distance. On other occasions, I might hit the corner flag. Just depends on the day. On this particular day, I hit the back of the net. Well done, me. In the final, it's another set play from across, from a free kick on a wide position. So there's all good intents and purposes. It's a cross. I get up above. Jim Leighton, the then Manchester United goalkeeper, gets caught between goal and myself in what we sort of no man's land refer to. And just loops in. Steve Bruce tries his best to clear it off the line. Paul Ince always, when I meet him, says, "Are you still claiming that as a goal?" I said, "Of course I am." Phone Brucey up and ask him if he wants an own goal on his record. Good, I'll take it then. So that's how we do. That's how we work this. So that's how it goes. We knew we could get an advantage. I mean, that first, the game I score in the final goes to extra time. There are two strikers. Both score two goals each in this game. One of them starts the whole game, Mark Hughes. The other comes on as a substitute and scores twice, and that's Ian Wright. So yeah, it's a very memorable, you know, a 6-goal FA Cup final is one that will stick in the memory.
Yeah.
So yeah,
most definitely.
Defense is on top, I believe the summary would have been.
How many of these guys that you played with are you still in touch with?
From time to time, because I'm now based here, obviously not as much. Although if I get involved with SiriusXM, which I do, because quite often I host either Grumpy Pundits or the football show or co-host, then we have players on and I talk to, you know, I get to sort of reignite. I see the Tottenham guys from time to time. If I go back to the UK, I will be at either Crystal Palace or Brighton. So I can bump into, you know, when I was at Brighton back end of 2018, Alan Mullery, the former manager, Gary Stevens, a teammate of mine at Tottenham, and a former Brighton player. So bump into him. We have a chit chat and sort of move on. Crystal Palace, quite a bit. Because if I go back, they ask me if I would host a lounge. So Mark Bright, half of the infamous Wright and Bright duo. See Jeff Thomas from time to time, who's now become a fabulous ambassador for charity. Having survived a bone marrow transplant for leukemia and does all of that through cycling. So, you know, credit to him. Absolutely fabulous.
Now, there aren't too many ex-players who go on to become... There's a lot of guys that go into media, but they become pundits, not necessarily hosts. Now, you can do the punditry, but Gary Lineker is about the only other guy I can think of who has become a host.
Back in the UK, it's not as obvious to go into the role of host as it is to just sit there and talk about things you're very comfortable in. To be a host, as well you know, takes a lot more. It's seeing it from a different point of view, a different angle. To be able to view it from that angle, okay. But then to know the guest or guests and know where your story has to go, but know where their story has to go.
Right.
Is there something in their story that hasn't quite been looked at? And bring that forward, and thinking. And not everybody is adaptable. Not everybody wants to take that responsibility. You know, why do more training than you need to?
Well, yeah.
I'm being unfair. I find, you know, former teammates and guys who I played with, very few of them are formally educated. So you will not find everyone in the locker room college educated.
Right.
You will most likely find nobody in the locker room has any college education. There's quite a few have no education beyond formal education beyond the age of 16. This does not mean there's no intelligence in the room. To be an elite football player in, if we call it the English Premier League, the most competitive league in the world, takes intelligence. You can't just be someone who can run up and down and kick a ball hard. That won't work.
What did you do? Did you have a chance?
I stayed at school until I was 18.
Oh, okay.
And that was very rare. Mm-hmm. And I did have a scholarship offered to me here at Columbia in New York, way back when. Mm-hmm. And a Duke came as well. And my hand is held up. I did not know who they were.
Really?
Really. That's purely my ignorance. I do know now. In case someone is listening to that and say, who is this idiot? I am more than aware now. And I sort of think, wow, what an opportunity that could have been. But back then, soccer in the US at a collegiate level was in its infancy.
Right.
It was there. There was established parameters, but it was still in its infancy. Mm. And I was going to go to Loughborough University to follow a degree. And then I ended up being at Tottenham pre-season training to get fit to go to university. And by September, they just turned around to me as an 18-year-old and said, you want to sign a 2-year professional contract? Oh, okay. This is going to upset my father. Hmm. Mm. And the rest is history. And what's interesting is that, I mean, I'm on the bench for Tottenham as a substitute, as a teenager, and make my debut for Tottenham in the first team as a teenager. Mm-hmm. Now, the then manager, Keith Birkinshaw, will tell you, as far as I was concerned back then, that was probably a year too late. I know. Probably issues with my shyness. So I was amongst the group of players that came through. Mark Falco made his debut at 16. Hmm. Gary Brooke a month or so before me, and we were all three of us the same age group. Mm. So we're, you know, if you're looking at being at a club, you should be in the conversation by the time you're 19, 20. Mm. In the first team, you should be more than capable of holding your own with your ability level and knowledge of how to play. So I was, as you probably are aware now, quite a confident teenager. Without being stupid arrogant, mm-hmm. I was confident in my abilities, and I would have private conversations with the head coach to tell him so.
So going back to your process of becoming a host and doing media, how did that work for you once you were done playing?
I fell into it really quickly. I ended up on a cable TV show, a weekly show, all sport. Mm. It was in South London, so we had access to Crystal Palace, which was easy for me. But then Wimbledon, the former Wimbledon, the crazy gang Wimbledon. And then we had Surrey County Cricket Club, which is a professional elite cricket club. Mm. So we had high-end professional sport. And then I would be introducing the world record, former world record hold world champion arm wrestler. I know. And nice. It would be what, and I would go away. I'd have to research guests. I'd have to bring guests in, book them, interview them, wash up afterwards, Hoover, vacuum, and go home. But it was a little bit like that. But that was a great place to learn.
Yeah.
To think, understand, to see how people reacted to questions, see how things work. So you've got a chance. And then Sky Sports came along. And I began to sit there as a pundit. But they were aware that I was hosting a cable TV show. So they brought me in, screen tested me. I was then slated to do a 4-hour live show on a Sunday morning, so it was a post-game, pre-game, and then in the evening I was hosting NFL.
Okay.
So a busy day.
Yeah, seriously.
A busy day. But on the way to that, I worked for the BBC again. My first ever game on radio as a reporter, not as a game analyst, but as a reporter. And it was a test drive for the producer. One of my former teammates is in the studio, Garth Crooks, and he's with another host. And there's a whole group of us out at different games, the London-based clubs. Mm. I'm at Fulham versus Lincoln City.
Okay.
At this moment, Fulham are in Division 2, League 2. Mm. So way down there. It's Craven Cottage. Basically, it's the last game on the list to go to. I'm sat there post-game. It's kind of November, it's dark, it's chilly, it's damp, perfect London weather. They come to me. Okay, so, and it's been a stunning 0-0 draw and as dull as ditch water. I get about a third of the way down my notes and I'm reading and I'm very happy with myself and all the lights go out. And that's exactly what I do. I laugh. I'm live on air and I'm laughing. And Garth Crooks said, "What are you laughing at? Be professional." I said, "I'd love to be, but the lights have gone out and I can't see a thing. What would you like me to talk about now?" And so it was that kind of, you know what, if I can cope with that and move forward, I'm pretty comfortable that there won't be too many things I can't cope with. And that's how it worked out. I mean, I was doing NFL came to Europe and they had a European league, which was an interesting adventure for a couple of seasons. And I would be sat there in the studio. I'd be handling a live satellite feed from one country, Germany, and I'd be handling the exact same time the live satellite feed out of Spain. Mm-hmm. I'd be in the studio. I had guests. I had people like, oh, it was quarterback for the Buccaneers when they won Super Bowl, Brad Johnson. Mm. He was one of my first studio guests.
Nice.
So, you know, you have all of this sort of thing going on and thinking, all right, this is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. This nice. Is how it, this is how it should work. And you don't get arrogant. You just go, okay, this is how this works.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
What led to you coming to the United States?
I'd worked with Premier League Productions, which is more or less responsible for what you would see on NBC right now. Mm-hmm. Not to take away what Rebecca Lowe does and the Robbies do. That's their in-house pre-game show, and it's a very impressive show. What Premier League Productions did out of the UK was get commentary teams to all of the games, and I did that with them for years. And then they decided to build their own content channel. Mm-hmm. So I would host live global phone-in shows.
Okay.
You could Skype in, phone in, email, just don't throw a brick through the window with a piece of paper on it. Whatever it was, whatever way you wanted to approach the show, you could. And we were in South Africa, Australia, nice. Singapore, everywhere. And so I did that for a number of years. And then this opportunity to go to India came up with the Indian Super League. And it was the inaugural season, so I thought, wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. Ground floor, the potential for football to take off in India is immense. And not until I get there do I realize just how much potential there is. Mm. I mean, if it went down to Southwest India and Kerala, we're in a big stadium. It's a cricket field, and it's got a crown on it, and the wicket's in the middle, but they've made a soccer field out of it, and it's pretty decent. They made a good job of it. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize was the first game is 47,000 fans.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
By the third game they have in this venue, this place is rocking to the sound of 60,000+ fans. And they have brought drums. They are obliterating the sound on our broadcast.
Wow.
And they love it. They absolutely love it. And you go to the very northeast of India and there'll be 35,000 fans. You can come into Mumbai, you'll go to a stadium that's full with 25,000 fans. Yeah, the appetite in Goa, I mean, they need a bigger stadium.
Huh.
And they would fill it. It's just there. The appetite for football is there. And the Indian Super League was a wonderful adventure and I'm glad I took it. In a fabulous country, and that's why. And so that kind of, what's over here?
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity, so this sort of thing with playing with science was, yeah. So the thought process was again, this would be interesting to explore. It's not purely soccer. In fact, it's rarely soccer, but it allows me to expand my mind. It allows me to expand what I do. And yeah, I like the idea. I like the concept. I'm attracted towards this project. So that's what brought me here. You know, this attitude of, what's it like here? This would be an interesting place to explore. This is a really interesting project, even more attractive, you know, when you add them all together. So that was the basic drive for that.
What have you observed about soccer in the United States so far?
It's big. it's a lot bigger than people in the UK, in Europe, understand. It is not going to compete with NFL or NBA, but I don't believe it has to. It's big enough to stand on its own. And that is in the men's game and the women's game. Mm-hmm. If you look down into the second tier and you have now at the moment USL, that's a very fervent environment. And players that aren't involved in MLS directly have an opportunity to play professional, organized football at a good level. And those players that are sat in a farm system in MLS that wouldn't be able to get through because there are a queue of players are able to sharpen, work at, develop, understand more. And so this is progress from how far back, 15, 10, 5 years ago. So yeah, it's there. I look at it, I look at the sophistication that's come with it because American sport shares. So if there's a thought process and technology in NFL or NBA or NHL, that sharing happens mm-hmm. back down into MLS and vice versa. If, I mean, I don't think the GPS sort of trackers that they sort of put on the vest and sits between the shoulder blades right. of players, soccer players, don't know that that was used a lot here. It was in Europe for, and is, particularly for training. And, you know, I won't get to the boring stuff, but that's the sort of thing we would cover on Playing with Science. That's moved into mainstream major league sport here in the US. So there's a cross-fertilization right. of thinking and ideas. And that's, I mean, major okay, European coaches, big NFL fans.
Hmm.
Soccer coaches.
Like who?
Sir Alex.
Yeah.
I believe so. Harry Redknapp.
Okay.
I've seen you on that NFL show. It's good.
I imagine him saying this from a car window. But
No. Harry's fabulous. Alan Pardew's a big NFL fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a wonderful interview once with Harry Redknapp about his days in Seattle. And playing there, but also becoming part of the sports culture there. And that included the Sonics, who then existed in Seattle and were winning NBA titles. And I remember being asked by Redknapp, what happened to Freddie Brown, downtown Freddie Brown? And I had no idea I would ever be asked that question by Harry Redknapp, my aside.
I know. We're a surprising bunch, aren't we? So Guardiola is a big basketball fan.
Yeah.
But Guardiola absorbs all sorts of other sports. But if you look at FC Barcelona, the whole Barcelona sporting club, Barcelona, right. there's a major European basketball team there.
Yeah.
So he goes in there and he sees football played in a microcosm. And he looks at it and he sees how to distort, overload, break down, open up a defense. Sorry about that. And he thinks, I can use that. That's what I'm looking at. This, what am I seeing? And Cruyff would steer him to things like that. And Cruyff was a mathematician, you know, surprisingly enough. And it's, yeah, this cross-fertilization, this seeing other things and bringing bits and pieces out of it and test-driving it in your own sport. So the coaches love NFL because of the tactics, because of the organization. And if you look at the game of football right now, the set play within free play is prevalent.
Yeah.
Something that you would never, ever say 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Now it's prevalent. Now this is the evolution of the game, the changing, the open-mindedness we touched on previously.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was up at in Boston at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference last week.
Yeah.
And it's always fascinating to see what's being talked about on all the panels for different sports too. But in soccer terms, Ted Knudsen, the American who runs StatsBomb, an analytics company over in the UK, was speaking about, he really thinks set pieces are an area that are going to be studied even more, and teams are going to devote even more and more time to trying to get as many goals as possible per season out of that.
Do you know how far back the analytics of set plays goes?
Tell me.
Something like the 66 World Cup. I know that's because England won. Gary, please calm down. I think the stat was something over 60% of goals scored in that World Cup were from set pieces. It's always been an understanding. We were talent poor or undeveloped. Crystal Palace in 1989, 1990, 1991 weren't a team of mature, hardened, experienced elite players. There were a lot of young players coming through, like John Solarco, Richard Shaw, Gareth Southgate was yet to emerge. Ian Wright was still a precocious young player, even though in his mid-20s. He hadn't had a lot of experience coming through a system. He came into professional football at the age of 24. Right. Alan Pardew came in at the age of 27.
Ah.
Yeah. So you're looking at that and saying, well, how do we level this particular playing field? Set plays.
Mm-hmm.
It's cost effective. I know I sound like the middle level management of some company. We can work on this. We need somebody whose delivery is good consistently. Phil Barber, left winger, you'll do. And he had that consistency of delivery. Do we have any? But one teammate, I love this expression, roof inspectors. Yeah, i.e. tall guys, right? I know, football wit, huh? And so can we do that? And then can we achieve certain things in the way we do stuff? Can we cause a diversion? Set play within free play, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, and we worked hard. We thought about how we would spend hours working attack versus defence, back four, a goalkeeper, and then you'd overload it. 7 versus 4 or 6 versus 4. You might add a midfield player in just to give you a bit of a breather. And you'd work. Yeah. And so you would drill and organise. And it's things like that. And now this is a no-brainer for any coach at any level now.
And anyone who views it as a stigma to be scoring on set pieces should get out of town, for one thing. But also, it's not just teams that are underdogs that can make the most of set pieces. It's very good teams as well. It's not like a zero-sum game where if you're good at scoring on set pieces, you're not good at scoring out of the run of play.
No, we're too posh to score set plays. We have to create by 1,000 passes, and it must be a precise laser-guided pass to the right big toe of our striker. No, it's a goal. If your goal is a set play and you win every game 1-0, by the way, you're champions.
It seemed almost like the England going to the semifinals of the World Cup last summer and scoring so many goals off of set pieces. There was almost an embarrassment from some people I talked to about...
Where did the manager come from? Any ideas? Any thoughts? When Gareth Southgate first played his football and when? Yes. And I used to drive him to training. No, I did.
That's amazing. That's great.
I used to drive Gareth Southgate to training as a 16-year-old. And ironically enough, when I was a teenager, I grew up in the same town as Glenn Hoddle.
Huh.
Who used to drive a mile the wrong way, pick me up and drive me to training. The connection between Gareth and Glenn is they have one is now and one is a past England manager.
Yeah.
And two fabulous guys, and Glenn, the best player of his generation in the UK. But that's a long story for another podcast.
We're wrapping up this one. I could sit here for 4 or 5 hours with you, as you know. Would you be interested in, I mean, you're a busy guy, but like, would you be interested in doing television commentary of soccer here in the U.S.?
100%. I would like that. I've explored it. It's not been open as of yet. But that is something MLS, I've had discussions with a number of people, and we're seeing if there's an opening at any point. Hopefully there will be. I have done some TV commentary for USL, which, and for the National Women's Soccer League, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. A bit like scoring a set play. I don't see it beneath me. These are professional soccer players that deserve respect, and that's what I would hopefully bring to every single broadcast. I would love to. I think playing with science is ideal to take to television. So if anybody out there is listening, please contact Grant. He will he will come to me on the phone and ask for a certain percentage as my agent. So yeah, playing with science would be a fabulous adventure for television. I'd like to. At the moment, I'm in the process of going through a green card. If and when I can establish that, I'd like to get involved in a professional environment. Maybe on a development on a technical side,
yeah,
to bring experience. I mean, I've spent years on player identification and recruitment for people like Nike and Adidas. Have an awful lot of playing experience, which I can sit and think about, or I can use and exchange with younger players who aren't yet there, but would benefit. That would be me giving back. That would be something that I would feel good about, because I got given knowledge as a young player. And how much of that knowledge is available here? There's plenty of knowledge. It's how much is coming back. I would imagine the pros that have come back from Europe are very open and would give to those younger players. So by all means, I mean, I'd like to join that band of players. Yeah.
Well, one of the great things I think about American soccer these days is we're open to anyone who wants to come and be a part of it. And you're very welcome here, and I hope you stick around and continue to be involved.
I do. I mean, I said I'd love to be involved more in the football landscape. I have a presence within Sirius XMFC, and that's thoroughly enjoyable. I'd like to take that into television. If that opportunity is there, I would embrace that. And as I say, to have an involvement in a professional organization at some point in the near future, that would be good, because it would mean that whatever I've got, I can hand back and can be utilized and brought forward. And the other thing is, if I get involved in a professional organization, I will be learning. It's not about Gary's telling you how to do this. It's way the opposite way around. There's an awful lot for me to learn, and I'm happy to sit down and be taught about. You know, there's a lot of sophisticated thinking. There's a lot of good practice here, and wouldn't be a bad thing to have a part of that.
Gary O'Reilly is a host of the podcast Playing with Science. You can find him on Twitter at @my3leftfeet. Gary, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure's been mine. Thank you, Grant.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Gary O'Reilly, as well as producer Brandon Nix, and everyone at Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. See you next time.
First Merchants Bank has your best interest at heart. And by best interest, we mean more than just our competitive rates.
We mean flexible account options for your every need.
And mortgage experts like me to help you buy your dream home.
Don't forget our attentive commercial bankers here to help your business thrive.
At First Merchants,
we know.
Your best interest is a bank that's interested in your success. Learn more at firstmerchants.com/switch. First Merchants Bank, helping you prosper. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's Durafighter interior paint is a paint and primer in one with a tough, lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's Durafighter paint and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save.